My name is Gordon Johnson. I'm president of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and I'm here in the Betty Woolley Garden outside the Lee Seng Tee Hall, where we're about to hear the second Lee Seng Tee Distinguished Lecture. It's being given this year by David Reynolds, Professor of International History at Cambridge, and he's going to talk about the changing map of Europe in the 20th century. These lectures are an opportunity for the college to participate in the university's main mission of encouraging research and of bringing the results of that research to the widest possible audience. So we are delighted to have this opportunity to do so in this, the university's 800th anniversary year. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this evening's lecture. It's good to see you all here. The lecture was endowed, or is endowed, by Dr. Lee Seng Tee, who is one of Cambridge's great benefactors, and to help the college at its 40th anniversary, he decided that we needed to have an opportunity to invite a distinguished lecturer to give a lecture on any subject of the lecturer's choice. The lecture is designed really to complement Dr. Lee's benefaction to the university, where there is an annual lecture given on a topic related to the public policy implications of research in science, technology, and medicine. So, since we were given a free hand with our lecture at Wolfson, we decided that at least for the first few lectures, we would show off the arts and the humanities. And Dr. Lee is a great reader of history, and he approves enormously of this development. And he is also a great student of military history in particular, and of 20th century history, a voracious reader in that area. His benefactions to this college have been very significant. The hall in which we are sitting now, the library building, and various other sort of bits and pieces over the years. So we are very grateful to him, and similarly his wider benefactions in the university are very noteworthy. Now tonight's lecture, since the only criterion that we're to use for choosing a lecturer, is to have someone of enormous distinction. And we have no problem tonight in meeting that criterion, because David Reynolds, who is a Fellow of Christ's College and a Fellow of the British Academy, is Professor of International History in the University of Cambridge. When he was much younger, he was successively a Choate Fellow and then a Warren Fellow at Harvard, and before that he was a student and a research fellow at Gonville and Caius College. His first book, which was The Creation of the Anglo-American Alliance, 1937-41, won the Bernath Prize, which is awarded by the Society for the History of American Foreign Relations. And a number of books on subjects in mainly mid-20th century Anglo-American relations or Anglo-American interests are followed. These included a fascinating study, Rich Relations, The American Occupation of Britain, 1942-45, which won the Society of Military History's Distinguished Book Award. And then there have been more popular books from World War to Cold War, and then his study of six particular international incidents that was published two or three years ago. And most recently, of course, has been his book, America, Empire of Liberty, A New History, which has received rave reviews wherever you look. Besides these books, which are mainly on topics of international history, he also wrote a wonderful book about Churchill, who is a very difficult person to write about, really, partly because there is so much material and there are so many other historians in the field. But David's book, In Command of History, Churchill Fighting and Writing the Second World War, won the Wolfson History Prize in 2006. Many of you, I know, will probably have come across him as a broadcaster, both on television and on radio. And not least of his charms is the fact that he is absolutely delightful doing the voices of various significant people. Perhaps he will do that tonight too. And of course, he has this amazing facility to make very complicated political matters appear to be simple, or at least so that us ordinary mortals can comprehend them. So it's with very great pleasure that I invite David to deliver this year's Lee Seng Tee Distinguished Lecture on the subject, Geography Costs, the Changing Map of Europe, 1909 to 2009. David.
Well, thank you very much, Gordon, for that kind introduction. I think maybe I will sign you up as my agent in future. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a great pleasure and honour to be asked to give this lecture, endowed by a very distinguished benefactor of the college and the university. And I think that's particularly appropriate to acknowledge in this 800th year when we are so conscious of all that we have owed and will owe in the future to our benefactors. My feeling about lectures after 5 o'clock is that you have come to the end of the working day. You are not here entirely to be edified. You hope also to be entertained, and I will try to do that. So one way of doing it is to provide a little bit of variation from me droning on by having a number of images on the screen. And that's particularly relevant, I think, because I'm talking about maps, and so there will be some maps on the screen, but also some other images as well. 2009, a year of anniversaries. A lot of nines have come up this year in a way that echoes back over the last century of European history. Let's take a look at some of them. 90 years since the Treaty of Versailles ended the First World War. 60 years since the outbreak of the Second World War. 50 years since the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty. And 20 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall heralded the end of the Iron Curtain of the divided Europe. So I want to look at those anniversaries. I want to look at some of the maps that surround those dates and events and try and talk about the way that Europe has changed. But to look at changing maps is in itself a rather abstract and bloodless thing, because to change the map of Europe has costs, and that's what my title tries to convey. It's a quotation from the American poet Carl Sandburg, "Geography costs. Why does the map of Europe never stay put?" He wrote that in 1940 at a particularly moving time in more ways than one in European history, and it gives me the title of my talk tonight. So the changing map of Europe and the costs of change. Let's look at some of those costs just briefly so that we have a sense of the last century. The human costs in lives, maybe 10 million dead in the First World War, perhaps 9/10 of them in Europe. Maybe 50 million, we really do not know, in the Second World War, perhaps 2/3 of those in Europe. And of those 50 million, maybe 28 million from the Soviet Union, 1/7 of the pre-war population. And that's a figure and an impact that I'll come back to on a number of occasions. But also the human cost of moving the map of Europe in terms of people moving, refugees. 5 million refugees in the course of the First World War, 10 million displaced after the war. 9 million refugees in the Second World War, 11 million people deported for Nazi labour during the Second World War, maybe 25 million people displaced after 1945, perhaps half of those German, 12 million people deported in the Stalin era in the Soviet Union, and 4 million people who were moved as a consequence of the changing map of Europe after the Iron Curtain came down. So the human costs of historical change. But since that may all sound like you're in for a pretty grim hour, let me promise you that there will be a few moments of light relief as well. Okay, so let us start with 100 years ago today. What important event happened 100 years ago today? Well, of course, it's the first day of the first Ashes test, England versus Australia. That is Edgbaston, not quite as it looks today, in Birmingham. And what is more important, the Australians have just lost a wicket. In fact, they lose a lot of wickets that first day. They are bowled out for 74 on a drying wicket. England go on to win the match by 10 wickets. Hobbs and Fry knock off the runs. So this is a red-letter day. However, after that, it all goes downhill rather fast. England win the first test. The Australians win the next two. The last two are drawn, so England lose the Ashes. I think it's worth mentioning that, partly because, of course, it is literally an anniversary today, and also, of course, because the Australians will be coming back next month to compete for the Ashes once again. And that's something I will also come back to later on. What else is happening? Edward Elgar is composing his Elegy for Strings. It was the piece that was playing vaguely in the background as you came in. It's a short piece that he wrote in Hereford in April and May 1909. It was played for the first time on the 13th of July. Although it has a formal dedication to somebody else, it's generally thought that it was actually an elegy for August Jaeger, who was, the man who copied Elgar's music for Novello, for the publishers, and was Nimrod in the Enigma Variations. Okay, one other thing that's worth mentioning about 1909. A slightly strange picture. If you can't make it out, you're sitting at the back. Well, tough, you should have been sitting nearer the front. But let me tell you what it says. Foreign dignitaries in London, it's a press cutting, foreign dignitaries in London, representatives of Russian Duma, of the Russian Parliament. Now, why is that significant? Well, because Russia has only just had developed a parliament from 1905. And the visit of these Russian parliamentarians was a very important moment in Anglo-Russian relations, encouraging a sense that Russia was coming in from the cold, coming into the community of Europe. Back in the early 19th century, Russia had been depicted in many parts of Western Europe as a kind of Oriental despotism. But then in the later 19th century, you have, for example, the emancipation of the serfs in 1861. That's 2 years before the Empire of Liberty got round to freeing the slaves, but we won't mention that tonight. Also, the industrial modernization of Russia in the late 19th century, the Trans-Siberian Railway, which was seen very much as an indicator of Russia's modernization, and then a parliament. So there was a sense, particularly in liberal England, that of convergence, of this country now becoming, moving towards the European norm. Okay, there were a few local problems, like a small revolution in 1905 and so on, but generally the feeling was that this was a positive sign. And that, I think, is interesting and important because it reminds us of the ambiguity of Russia's position in relation to Europe, something I will want to talk about a bit tonight. Here's the image of the bronze horseman. It's a statue of Peter the Great, erected by Catherine the Great in St. Petersburg. This is a picture by the Russian painter Vasily Surikov around this sort of time, 100 years ago. It also evoked, and indeed the title of the statue, as it's now known in Russia, the Bronze Horseman, really comes from a poem by Pushkin, written in the 1830s, though not published until after his death in a duel, I think, in 1837. And Pushkin, in that poem, talked of Russia's relationship to the wider world. Here are a few lines from the poem. "Here shall be a city laid down in defiance to a haughty neighbour. Here nature has predestined us to break a window through to Europe." To break a window through to Europe. That is the part of what that image of the Bronze Horseman evokes, of an opening up to Europe. But also, this is a poem that Russian people, especially in Russian literature, will know far better than I do, is much discussed as to its meaning. But there's another aspect to it which is striking as well. Here's one of the illustrations for Pushkin's poem, which he wrote, as I say, in 1833. And it shows, on the one hand, the Bronze Horseman, on the other, a Russian inhabitant of St. Petersburg, Yevgeny. And much of the story is about the flood that overtakes St. Petersburg, Yevgeny's search for his the woman, his beloved, who is drowned in that flood, and then the way that he goes and rails against the statue, against Peter the Great, for creating this city in a kind of megalomaniac way in a place that was a swamp that was liable to flooding and so on. And then, to his horror, the horseman comes alive and chases Yevgeny, and you can see him in the bottom left-hand corner there, chases him in the end to his death. So this is a powerful, powerful image of a horseman that evokes the sense of an opening to Europe, but also poses the question, what is the relation between the city and the citizen? What is the place of the people in the Russian state? And so those themes of the opening to Europe and the place of the people are ones I shall come back to, but that is partly why the visit of the Duma was so important in 1909, giving a sense that, yes, this was an opening door, that Russia, in a sense, was coming in from the cold. So let's have a look at the map of Europe in 1909. The striking part is really Central and Eastern Europe, and this is the area that I'm going to keep on looking at this evening. And that, you can see, is dominated by four big empires. The new German Reich, the Habsburg monarchy, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire down here, which is still a power in Europe itself, though a receding power, and the great Russian Empire. These are all empires that are developing some kind of representative systems, but in somewhat problematic ways, and they are the main predominant feature of Central and Eastern Europe, and that's what will change dramatically as we follow it through the century. The most sensitive area, of course, is the Balkans, where the Ottoman Empire has been receding, the Habsburg Empire has been expanding as the Ottomans contract, but also nationalist movements are seeking their own independence from those two empires. And in particular, 1909, they're just resolving a crisis over Bosnia and Herzegovina, and the question of those states and of Serbia within the empire, within relations with the Habsburg Empire, is at the centre of the next few years. So let's fast forward to 1914. Sarajevo, 28th of June, that's an image of the assassination of the Archduke, the heir to the heir to the Habsburg throne, by the Serbian, the young Serbian terrorist, Gavrilo Princip, who's down in the bottom left here. I'm told I mustn't touch the screen because it will explode, so I've got to be very careful, but he's down there, and there's the Archduke and his wife. Well, that's what I was told, anyway. So. And this is, of course, the shot that in many ways triggers the war. Princip is actually under 20, and therefore he is too young. He's arrested. He's too young to be executed. So he's imprisoned, and we'll come back to him also later on. But this shot starts a crisis, a local crisis, as you know, which then expands to draw in the other powers of Europe. I'm not going to begin to get into the genealogy of the First World War because we wouldn't get out of the 1910s this evening at all. So let's just remind ourselves of Europe's wasteland as this short war becomes a long war in which millions die, maybe 10 million, as I say. And fast forward to the first of my big anniversaries, the Treaty of Versailles. The second Treaty of Versailles. Because the first one, of course, was the treaty in 1871, under which Bismarck reclaimed Alsace and Lorraine from France at the end of the Franco-Prussian War, proclaimed the German Empire, the German Reich, and did it just to rub it in the great centrepiece of France's glory, the Palace of Versailles. So, very deliberately, when the French beat the Germans, they wished to restage that conference with the Germans on the defeated side. 28th of June, again, a deliberate date, 5 years since the assassination at Sarajevo. This is about history being rubbed in hard. So into that glittering array of delegates, at the far end, you can see a door down the far end, I think, are introduced the two defeated, the two representatives of defeated Germany, because, of course, Germany has crumbled not just into defeat, but into revolution and total collapse. And a peace that was initially intended to be a negotiated peace ends up as being a peace that is enforced upon them. Harold Nicholson, the British diplomat, was one of those in that crowd, and he records vividly the moment when the two German delegates come in. Isolated and pitiable come Dr. Müller and Dr. Bell. The silence is terrifying. Their feet upon a strip of parquet between the carpets echo hollow and duplicate. They keep their eyes fixed away from those 2,000 staring eyes. They keep them fixed upon the ceiling. They are deathly pale. They do not appear as representatives of a brutal militarism. The one is thin and pink eyelided, a sort of second fiddle in a Brunswick orchestra. The other is moon-faced and suffering, a junior lecturer. It's all most painful. Nicholson was one of those who resigned in disgust from the British delegation and soon after from the Foreign Office. So what is the result of that treaty in terms of our map of Europe, or at least what does the map of Europe look like after the war settled down? That's not exactly 1919 because we have to take into account the fallout from the Russo-Polish War and the Greco-Turkish Wars. But by the 1920s, that is the map of Europe, broadly speaking. And what you see particularly is, of course, this massive change in Eastern and East Central Europe. The big empires have disappeared, at least three of them out of the four. The German Reich has been truncated. The Habsburg Empire has been broken up. You have Austria and Hungary as separate states, and then the rest of their empire reconstituted Czechoslovakia, a much larger Romania, and so on. The Ottoman Empire is now pretty much entirely... the Ottoman Empire has disappeared. Turkey is almost entirely a power in Asia Minor, not in Europe. Remember, this is the Ottoman Empire at its peak was right up at the gates of Vienna in the 1680s. So Turkey has contracted, indeed, for a while. It seemed that it might not exist at all. So three great empires have disappeared. Germany is now a struggling coalition government, a leftist government at this stage, an increasingly fragile one. The one empire that has survived in a truncated form is this one, the Soviet Union. Its borders have been trimmed dramatically. the Baltic states recovering independence, a new Poland, which I'll talk more about in a moment. But despite the struggles of the Civil War, the Russian Empire does not fall completely under. It's now reconstituted, but under new leadership, under the Bolshevik leadership. A revolution has happened, a Marxist revolution has happened in the most unlikely part of Europe. And the persistence of the Russian Empire for much of the 20th century is one of the themes that I want to follow on in the next few minutes. So three empires disappear. One continues in a truncated form under new leaders. Let's look a little more closely at what has happened to the map of East Central Europe, and in particular, the new state of Poland. Now, again, if you're sitting at the back, you won't get the full beauty of this black and white picture. Nevertheless, this is all territory hatched vertically that was lost by Russia, the new Baltic states, and a large tract of the reinvention of Poland. The horizontal stripes are territory lost by the Habsburg Empire, creating in particular the new state of Czechoslovakia and a much larger Romania. Now, it's often said that what comes out of the First World War are new national states. But if we look more closely at these states, we see that their problem is that they're not truly national states, but multinational states. Let's take the case of Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia in 1930 is just about majority Czech, but it has huge minority groups. Nearly a quarter of the population are German. Slovaks, 16%, Hungarians, 5%, Russian Ukrainians, 4%. That is a very unstable country. And indeed, the relationships between the ethnic groups, and particularly between the Czechs and the Germans, is, of course, the cause of the international crisis of 1938, leading to the Munich settlement eventually. Let's take Poland. Only about two-thirds of the population are Polish. Ukrainians, 16%. Jews, a fateful figure, 10%. White Russians, 5%. Germans, 2%. The ethnic complexities of Poland and the fact that Poland has been reinvented at the expense particularly of Germany and Russia, that is the cause of the war in 1939. It's the basis of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, and in the end it's the reason why Britain and France go to war. The debris from 1919 is really the fuel for the next conflict. And the sparks are Germany and Russia's determination to revise that peace settlement, a settlement in Eastern Europe that was predominantly at their expense. And the Nazi-Soviet Pact, as I say, is particularly focused on Poland. So let's look at how Poland, having gained its independence in 1918, is partitioned yet again in 1939. This map shows you, I think, rather graphically, the cost of being Poland, or trying to be Poland. That map at the top is really basically the situation up to 1918. There is no Polish state. From 21 to 39, there is a Polish state. From 1939 to 45, there isn't one again. It's divided between the Russians and the Germans, and of course the Germans take it all over in 1941. So 1939 is a significant date for Eastern Europe and particularly for Poland. But in a lot of ways, it's actually not the date that is really significant. The war starts in 39, but as you know, it's a phony war. In 1940, things change dramatically. That is the year of revolution. Just to remind you, it's a lucky revolution. Had the Germans decided to attack through Belgium, as was their original intention, they would have ended up with a big encounter battle with the French army. Instead, the change of plan that winter, the German army, the 10 armoured divisions driving through the Ardennes, round the back of the British and French army to the coast. That decides the war in really almost a matter of days. Certainly, but in 4 weeks, it's clear that this jumped-up Austrian corporal has done what the Kaiser's best generals could not manage in 4 years and knocked France out of the war. He's got to Paris. And that means that the Second World War is fundamentally different from the Second World War. All through the First World War, however bad things were, in August 14 or March 1918, there was always a Western Front. There is no Western Front by June 1914. And that leaves Hitler in such a dominant position in Europe that any change in Hitler's dominance will involve almost seismic shifts in the whole relationship of Europe to its neighbours, and that's something I shall also get onto. So let's look at Hitler's new order with this new map. By December 1942, he controls something like a third of the territory of Europe and maybe half its people. And they are now in a position, Hitler and the Nazi Party, to engage in their real project, to Germanize the East. Himmler writes this in the summer of 1942. He said, "Our mission is not to Germanize the East in the old sense, bringing the German language and laws to those living there, but rather to ensure that in the East dwell only men with truly German, Germanic blood." So that project of Germanizing the East is at the heart of the Second World War, a war that we in Britain and America, Canada and so on still tend to think of very much in terms of Western Europe, but it's Eastern Europe that is the central battleground. Let's take, for example, the Siege of Leningrad, the new name for St. Petersburg. That lasts from the autumn of 1941 until the beginning, till January 1944, until it's finally relieved, the city is finally relieved. That's something like 900 days. The death toll is not known. Perhaps 900,000 dead, maybe a million. Or to put it another way, more Russians die in the Siege of Leningrad than the total British and American combat dead for the whole war combined. More Russians die in Leningrad than the total British and American dead from the war. Throughout the war, the Bronze Horseman stays in the city. There is a saying that if the horseman leaves, the city will fall. So it is not taken down in any way. It is, indeed, it would be a huge task given that enormous rock at the bottom. But it's boarded up, it's covered, it's protected, it's sandbagged, it's camouflaged against German planes, and it sees the war out and it sees the city to victory. So Germanizing the East is partly about that battle between Hitler and the Slavs. Had he won, it was his determination to raise the city of Leningrad to the ground. But Germanizing the East is also about the final solution to the Jewish problem, as it is called. Rather than show you pictures, more familiar pictures, I've taken a picture of Theresienstadt, which was not one of the major extermination camps. It's about 30 miles north of Prague. It was a Habsburg garrison town, and you can see a picture of the fortress there. Built in the 1780s, it was built by Joseph II. It was named for his mother, Maria Theresa, hence the name Theresienstadt. It was basically a transit camp for Jews who went on to Auschwitz. But there was also, outside the encampment, the fortress, the town itself, a sort of garrison town, became a ghetto for Jews. And indeed, it was one of Himmler's more celebrated escapades that he persuaded a deputation from the Red Cross in 1944 that this was actually a model Jewish settlement They came in and they inspected, and it seemed that there were, the Jews were having schools and they were well fed and so on, and it was a complete contrick. One of the people in Theresienstadt was a young man called Pavel Friedman, born in Prague in 1921. So he was about 21 when he was taken to Theresienstadt. And he wrote a poem which some of you may know called The Butterfly, but I want to read it to you now. The last, the very last, so richly, brightly, dazzlingly yellow, like the sun's tear shattered on a white stone. Such a yellow is carried lightly, way up high. It went away, I'm sure, because it wished to kiss the world farewell. For 7 weeks I've lived here, penned up inside this ghetto. But I have found what I love here. The daisies call to me, and the white chestnut branches in the court. Only, I never saw another butterfly. That last one was the last one. Butterflies don't live here in the ghetto. Pavel Friedman died in Auschwitz in September 1944. So, Hitler's legacy, when that ghastly, gruesome project finally collapses in ruins around him and Germany. The division of his country, the partition of Europe between East and West, and the hegemony of what are now called the superpowers, a word that is coined in 1944. Because the defeat of that Third Reich in such a dominant position across Europe was not something that the Europeans could accomplish alone, as they had more or less done in 1914-1918. But in the Second World War, the role of the United States, important in 1918, was absolutely critical in winning victory in the West, and in the East, that was a war largely won by the Soviet Union. So these two superpowers are now in a dominant position in Europe. In the West, what do we see? Another anniversary. The new North Atlantic Treaty, 50 years ago this year. There's Harry Truman, the president, signing it. A novel American peacetime commitment to the security of Europe, the first time this has happened in peacetime, in which the signatories, 12 countries at this stage, United States, Canada, and then countries of Western Europe, pledge that an attack on one of them will be treated as an attack on all of them. And Truman, in signing this document, says very simply, he says it's a simple document, but if it had existed in 1914 and 1939, I believe it would have prevented the outbreak of aggression that led to two world wars. So how does Europe look in 1949? Well, we've now got a thicker line down here, which essentially marks the division of Europe, what Winston Churchill called the Iron Curtain. We've also got a divided Germany, West Germany, East Germany, and a divided Berlin. Let's look again at the sort of what is really the benchmark state, Poland. Poland has now moved west, to a small extent, but significantly. That's the Polish state in 21 to 39, and that's post-1945 Poland, when it's reinvented again after the Second World War. The reason it's moved is that the Ukraine has now gone to Russia, to the Soviet Union, and as compensation, Poland has received German territory in the West. So the black hatching here indicates the territory that has been lost by Germany. East Prussia goes to the Soviet Union, Polish territory as well. This part of Germany, what was Germany, Pomerania, Silesia, is now under Polish administration. And, of course, here, Alsace and Lorraine, the old battlegrounds between France and Germany, have reverted to France. And we also see here the divided Germany. There's the Soviet zone, the American one down in the south, down to Munich and the the Alps, the French in the Rhineland-Pfalz, and then the British up in the Ruhr and the Northwest. Or as one joke had it, the Russians got the corn, the Americans got the scenery, the French got the wine, and the British got the ruins. But, as I said, geography costs. Changing the map involves human suffering, ethnic cleansing on a substantial scale. Let's think about that new Poland. It's now 98% Polish, almost purely a pure Polish state, because the Ukrainians have gone to the Soviet Union and because the Jews have been virtually exterminated. Czechoslovakia. The German population, nearly a quarter of it, of a country in 1938-39, is now largely expelled. Something like 2.5 million Germans are forced to leave. Two-thirds of them go to West Germany. In fact, by 1950, expellees, the so-called Vertriebenen, are nearly a fifth of the population of West Germany. People who have come from the Polish lands, Czech lands, from the old German communities in Russia, these are all now in the new West Germany. So huge human movements. Go back to Theresienstadt again. There is the Jewish memorial. The fortress, incidentally, is the place where Princip, Gavrilo Princip, who had fired the fatal shot in 1914, died of tuberculosis in 1918. Theresienstadt is liberated by the Russians at the very end of the war, May the 8th, May the 9th, 1945. And they begin the grisly task of burying the dead, helping the survivors, cleaning up the town and the fortress. But the fortress, by May the 10th, is already receiving new inmates. Germans who are now being driven out of Czechoslovakia by the new government are on their way to Germany. And a man called Adler, a Jew who had been an inmate of Theresienstadt under the Nazi regime, commented now on what happened when new arrivals came. Many of them had undoubtedly been guilty during the years of occupation, but in the majority, they were children and juveniles who had only been locked up because they were Germans. Only because they were Germans. This sentence sounds frighteningly familiar. Just the word Jews had been changed to Germans. The rags the Germans had been clothed with were smeared with swastikas. The people were abominably fed and maltreated, and they were no better off than I was used to in a German concentration camp. Okay, so far a rather grim story, but not entirely. Not just revenge, but also in post-1945 Europe, reconciliation. And here is a map of reconciliation, though you might not have recognised it as such immediately. The European Economic Community, not a particularly popular organisation in this country in its various mutations, European Union and so on, but one that I think we need to understand its genesis to appreciate its significance. Because at the core of this is a new relationship between France and West Germany. This is, in a way, the peace settlement. The community comes into existence in January 1958, before Charles de Gaulle comes to power, before the Fifth Republic is established. But de Gaulle is the person who can make or break this institution. He was not in favour of it before. It's not clear that he will be reconciled to it once he comes to power. Certainly Konrad Adenauer, the German Chancellor who believes passionately in the need for reconciliation between France and Germany and for the European community to be the form of that, Adenauer is deeply pessimistic about de Gaulle's reaction. He's invited to meet de Gaulle on the 14th of September 1958. And he drives to de Gaulle's home in Colombelles des Églises in Champagne. He drives across the old battlefields of Alsace and Lorraine, and he reflects on the fact that de Gaulle spent a good deal of the First World War in a German prisoner of war camp, and that he was, after all, the leader of the fighting French, the Free French, in 1940s. So there are many reasons why de Gaulle would not want to welcome a German. But in fact, that meeting is profoundly important. It's in fact the only time that de Gaulle ever welcomed a foreign leader to his own home. He was an intensely private man. This was a very rare exception. Ardenas spent a visit there with de Gaulle, with his wife. He was treated as a member of the family. He was profoundly impressed by de Gaulle, by de Gaulle's... well, by the fact, for a start, that de Gaulle spoke German. They didn't really need an interpreter. But also the French leader's commitment to a new Europe, to a new relationship between France and Germany. And the result of it is, for example, this moment, very moving moment in the Cathedral at Reims in July 1962, where the two leaders took Mass together at the high altar. Again, a richly symbolic location, because this was the coronation place for centuries of French kings. The cathedral had been gravely shelled by the Germans in the First World War, and Reims was also the city where the Wehrmacht surrendered in the West in May 1945. So this is now a place of reconciliation. And in thinking about the European community and its evident and manifold deficiencies, we need to, I think, remember what its roots were in that fundamental Franco-German reconciliation. Up between 1870 and 1945, the French and the Germans had fought three ruinous wars in 75 years. After that, they buried the hatchet and they worked together within that framework. So during the Cold War, Western Europe is increasingly integrated. European integration within a divided continent. Britain, UK, Ireland and Denmark joining in 1973, and then a further enlargement in the 80s, Greece, Spain and Portugal. But in the Soviet in the East, it's a story of forced integration. Remind you again of familiar events. 1961, the Berlin Wall going up in the divided city, now formalising in concrete the divide between those two cities. 2 years later, John Kennedy comes to the city and he asks, in one of his most famous addresses, he asks those who claim they do not understand what is at stake in the Cold War, let them come to Berlin. 1968, the tanks in Prague, bringing to an end the Prague Spring. Although we speak of the two superpowers, the two divided Europes, sometimes the two empires in the West and the East, the American Empire in the East, under NATO, is fundamentally different from that forced integration of Eastern Europe. It is, in the words of one historian, empire by invitation. That is empire by coercion. But this is a Soviet Union, a Russian Empire under Bolshevik leadership that has now become nothing much more than an authoritarian bureaucracy. Here are the old guard of the 1980s, Brezhnev, Leonid Brezhnev in the far corner, Andropov, his successor, and Chernenko, all looking suitably ossified and fading away, and indeed they did. You remember the famous succession of deaths, Brezhnev in 82, Andropov a year later, Chernenko a year after that. So much so that when George Bush went to Andropov's funeral, he said to the staff at the American embassy in Moscow when he was leaving, he said, "Okay, see you again, same time, next year." And he was almost right. I think it was 14 months, not 12 months. And at the heart of this stagnation is Leonid Brezhnev. The Brezhnev era is when it all goes to seed. Here he is. This is described on the internet, let me get this right, as the sexiest picture of Leonid Brezhnev. Well, I don't know, each to her own, I suppose. But actually, Gordon, I shouldn't have put this up. It's before the 9 o'clock watershed, isn't it? So perhaps I should just take him down. But I do want to tell you a couple of Brezhnev jokes, because they do sum up something of this era of stagnation and the sense that the country had simply become ossified, that it was run by a bureaucracy that did everything by the book in a kind of mindless way. And these were the kind of jokes that circulated in Moscow in the 80s. I remember hearing one or two when I was there, and they were. It was amazing to listen to Russians saying these things behind closed doors. So, for example, Brezhnev is welcoming Mrs. Thatcher to Moscow. And he gets out his prompt card, because, of course, he's doing everything by prompt card. And he says, "We welcome you, Mrs. Gandhi." So an aide nudges him, long-suffering aide, and says, "Mrs. Thatcher." Brezhnev glares. "We welcome you, Mrs. Gandhi." "Leonid Ilyich, she is not Mrs. Gandhi. She is Mrs. Thatcher."
"You fool."
"I know that she is Mrs. Thatcher. But it says here, Mrs. Gandhi." There's another story about three Soviet leaders, Stalin, Khrushchev and Brezhnev, in a train going across the steppes. And the train comes to a halt. And so Stalin gets up and he says, "Shoot driver." So they shoot the driver. This isn't a true story, by the way. Shoot driver. They shoot driver. Nothing happens. So Khrushchev gets up and he says, "Rehabilitate driver." So they rehabilitate the driver. Still nothing happens. And then Brezhnev pulls the curtains of the compartment. And he smiles his hooded smile and he says, "Let's just pretend the train is moving." And that summed up the kind of con trick of the Soviet Union by the early 80s. And the pretense could not go on. Indeed, the day that Mikhail Gorbachev was, the night before he was elected formally as General Secretary, he went out into the garden with his wife. He couldn't stay in the house because it was bugged. And he said, "I have to do this job. We cannot go on like this." So, farewell to the Brezhnev era, quickly, and on to new thinking, to Gorbachev, and a completely different generation. Here he is with Mrs. Thatcher, just before he becomes General Secretary. Gorbachev is a completely different generation. He's born in 1931. Brezhnev was 1906, so 25 years separate them, but also an eternity in terms of values. Brezhnev, scarred by the Stalin era, by the suspicion and the bureaucracy, and also scarred by the German surprise attack of 1941, so always looking for surprise attack and danger in the future. Gorbachev, influenced by social democracy in Europe, Sweden, Germany and so on, looking for ways of changing Soviet thinking. The kind of buzzwords that of this time were Gorbachev talking about a common European home. All the countries of Europe shared a common European home. Talking also about all human values, meaning values that span the whole of humanity, not just values of one class or one nation. And so this is the new thinking. And for all Gorbachev's faults and his incredible naivety at times, he is, I think, of enormous importance, because he helps to ensure that the next change in the map of Europe happens incredibly, miraculously peacefully, relatively speaking, to all that had happened before. Well, you know the story. I'm not going to spend a long time on it. The Velvet Revolutions of 1989, there's our Hungarian troops taking down the border of Hungary, westwards. And that's tremendously important. It's often forgotten, but actually the opening of the Hungarian border is a catalyst for most else that happens later in the year, certainly in the movement of Germans west. That's Wenceslas Square in Prague, huge crowds of people, now very different from that image of 68 with the tanks. And, of course, also the breaching of the Berlin Wall, that symbol of Cold War and of repression. And at the heart of this revolution is what the Germans call Die Wende, the great turnaround in the whole position of their country. October 1989 was, in fact, the 40th anniversary of the German Democratic Republic, of the East German regime. And by then, Hungary and Poland had already opened up politically, so that there was an air of unbelievable unreality about these celebrations by an ossified German regime led by another gerontocrat, Erich Honecker. There's Gorbachev, he had to go and attend the celebrations. There's Honecker on the right, I think that's the interpreter in the middle, and you can see how much they're enjoying the occasion. It was excruciating. Gorbachev found Honecker completely unable to understand anything about reform and change, and Honecker regarded Gorbachev as undermining the regime. But Gorbachev records in his memoirs the scenes that he experienced as he drove into Berlin from Schönefeld Airport on the eastern side, and along almost the whole of the route there were young people shouting passionately, "Gorbachev, Gorbachev." And this was, of course, with Honecker right in the car beside him. He said that when he finally got back to Moscow, it was with a very real sense of alarm. He said, "The country, Germany, reminded me of an overheated boiler with the lid tightly closed. The danger was there for everyone to see, and subsequent events vindicated my premonitions." Indeed, the whole crisis in Germany of the war blew up only about 2 weeks later. That celebration of 40 years of the German Democratic Republic was also the wake as well. But the thing that Gorbachev insisted on all the way through, and he says this in his memoir, "It goes without saying that the events in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Germany, later on Romania, Bulgaria, caused us great concern. However, not once did we contemplate the possibility of going back on the fundamental principle of the new political thinking, freedom of choice and non-interference in other countries' domestic affairs." And that's the fundamental difference between 1989 and those other moments of turmoil in Eastern Europe, Hungary in 56, Czechoslovakia in 68, and what would have happened probably in Poland in 81 had the regime not invoked martial law. In other words, the Russians would have sent in the troops. Gorbachev did not do that. Indeed, in his treatment of Eastern Europe, and almost without significant exception, his own countrymen, he refused to use force in a way that had been used in the past to keep the map steady and stable. So he stuck to his principles despite the cost in terms of the geography of Europe. And of course, it was a process that spread to the Soviet Union itself, because it led within a couple of years to the disunion of the Soviet Union. The pattern there is that, of course, the increasing autonomy for the various republics, particularly the Baltic states, Georgia, Ukraine using their increasing autonomy to attack the hegemony of Russia. The Russian backlash, the backlash of Russia itself, the Russian Republic, against what was happening to the empire. And, of course, the famous attempted coup in August 1991, There's Gorbachev returning from the Crimea with his family in their dressing gowns to Moscow, having just about survived that coup, but coming back to a Moscow in which the person who now controls everything is the leader of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, and Gorbachev finds that he is the leader of a Soviet Union that has virtually ceased to exist. And, of course, it comes to an end at Christmas 1991. So let's have another final look at the map of Europe. Now, the big change is, of course, this part of the map has not changed very much, except that by 93 the Czech Republic and Slovakia have separated. The big change is the breakup of the Soviet Union, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, independent states, a Russian Federation that is, in the early 90s, in increasing chaos and, of course, economic crisis. But also, the expansion eastwards now of those institutions of Western Europe that had held Western Europe together during the Cold War, those institutions now embracing much of the continent. There's a map of the European Union in 2009. The yellow shows how far it has now extended, up into the Baltic states, Poland, down there, Romania and so on. 27 members, I think, of which 16 are in the Eurozone. And also NATO. The red indicates states that are not members of NATO. The blue, the states that are. The green ones, and those are particularly sensitive, are the ones that have been promised the chance to be admitted. The Ukraine, Georgia, flashpoints on the edge of the new Russia. 28 members in that. 12 of them in NATO. 28 members of NATO. 12 of them have joined since the end of the Cold War. So what we're now seeing is a new Europe that has moved increasingly and almost inexorably eastwards in a way that, to the new Russia, seems increasingly threatening. There's the new Russia. A hodgepodge of different polities. There are, I think, 83 different what are called federal subjects within Russia, having various degrees of autonomy and rights and so on of their own. And some of those are severely contested, for example, Chechnya and so on. So what we're talking about is a Russia that is in itself in flux and is in a very tense relationship with Western Europe. And under Vladimir Putin, that tension has become increasingly evident. Here is what Putin said in 2005, admittedly in an elections kind of speech, but still the sentiments, I think, are instructive. He said this: "The collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And for the Russian people, it became a real drama. Tens of millions of our citizens and compatriots found themselves outside the Russian Federation. Russia," he went on, "Russia is a country that, at the will of its own people, chose democracy for itself. It will decide for itself how it will ensure that the principles of freedom and democracy are implemented, taking into account its historical, geopolitical, and other characteristics." So in a way, we're kind of back where we were a few minutes ago, with the Bronze Horseman. Back with Russia's ambiguous relationship with the West. Only now it's a relationship with a Europe that has cohered and moved almost inexorably eastward. We're also back with the issue of Russia's uncertain commitment to liberalism, democracy, at least as known and understood in the rest of Europe. Is the horseman looking openly through windows to the West, or has it put up shutters? Is it a protector of the people or an oppressor? Now, I'm not trying to say that history in any simple sense repeats itself, but some problems do seem familiar. So there we are, 1909 to 2009. From one century to another, probably about 2 years per minute, I think. So it's been rather a race. From one century to another, from dust to dust, but also from ashes to ashes. Which is another reason why I hope that history will not repeat itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much indeed, David, for that sort of tour of the 20th century. I mean, the thing that sort of strikes me is, you know, because I'm a different sort of historian. I look at the good old British Empire, as it were. What you've said really points the need, doesn't it, for some sort of imperial structure to, and that, you know, the European Union is yet another sort of imperial structure of sorts, and that everything was splendid when those Ottomans and Habsburgs were in charge, in a manner of speaking.
Well, the British Foreign Office certainly spent most of the Second World War trying to reinvent the Habsburg Empire. They thought that was the only way to provide stability for the for the Danubian basin. So. Yes.
Now, we have a moment or two when we can have some questions, if you would like.
I'm Pierre, Tolson College, doing a PhD in international relations. Thank you very much. It was mostly illuminating what you've told us about the history and geography. In particular, I appreciate what you've said about my part of the world, about Russia and Ukraine. What I want to ask you, it's about figures, because you played with this 909, 49, etc. And what I wanted to ask you is, do you, as a historian, find any symbolism or mysticism in these figures? Because it's not only you, but I've read recently in Serbian press that 28th is actually a quite symbolic figure, and which repeats itself through the whole Serbian history. 28th of June was the date of the Saint Vit when they fought with Ottomans, Sarajevo, Vidovdan Constitution. 8th of November for Germans, that was also has also some symbolic repetitive meaning. So do you find anything in it, or it's just coincidence? Thanks.
Well, I had thought in advance of what questions might be asked me, but that one was not one that I had anticipated. However, it's a fair question. Yes, I mean, the 8th of November is a very, very, very poignant date in German history, 8th, 9th. I think that's probably what you've raised is a good subject for a PhD in metaphysics or something like that. No, I don't know. I mean, it is true that there are these interesting coincidences, but I can't say I have an interpretation of that, no.
Tony Brenton, former British ambassador in Russia. You spoke very interestingly, if I may say so, about Russia, and you alluded to the question as to whether Russia was a real European insider or doomed to be forever an outsider. How do you feel? Do you think in 10 years' time they will be inside or will continue to remain an outsider?
Well, I don't know, and I could probably throw the question back at you because you may be in a better position to answer it. But, I mean, I don't feel my predictive powers as a historian are very great, and I've tried to avoid it, but I certainly remember saying in the early 90s to people who were, as it were, euphoric about the changes in Russia and so on, you know, that I said, look, I think the wars of the Soviet succession have got several decades to run, and I still think that's the case. I think... Although I have, as it were, for the sake of an arc for this lecture, suggested a certain, you know, repetition, the Russia of Putin is so hugely different from, you know, the one of Vitter of the beginning of the 20th century that the differences are more striking than not. But... You know, the issues are ones that are were explored and discussed a lot about Eastern Europe in the post-communist transition. You know, what is the basis of civil society in these countries? You cannot create a political democracy without the underlying institutions of civil society. So that includes, you know, respect for contract, respect for rule of law, the idea of actually a private sphere as well as a public sphere. And those are things that do not happen overnight. So in a way, Russia is a victim of its history. If you go back, for example, to the beginning of the century, and I mentioned this improbability of a revolution happening in that the most backward peasant country of Europe, not in a bourgeois state. You know, Orlando Figes wrote a book about, you know, the revolution as the people's tragedy, that this was, you know, the consequence of that almost fortuitous coup by the Bolshevik Party in the circumstances of chaos of 1917, was at the expense of the Russian people and at the expense of a steady evolution towards creating civil society in the way that had happened in Central Europe and Western Europe. And that's why that, you know, the visit of the Duma was a kind of false dawn in a way. So my feeling is that, you know, once Russia went right down to the pits, as you know, in the mid-90s, it's been pulled out through a huge effort of will and power by Putin. And we will have to move on beyond the post-Putin era, however long that is, before we see what can then be constructed in terms of a more pluralist society that we would recognise in the West. So, you know, I'm not giving you a straight answer. Maybe you would like to come back at me, but, you know, I'm saying this is a long game.
Charles Barton, what do you think the role of the United States and policy of the United States to the new Europe should be?
Well, the United States has, in a sense, through the history of the European Union, had a somewhat ambiguous attitude in that, on the one hand, it was in favour of peacemaking between the old warring powers. It was in favour of greater European cooperation, but then in the 60s and 70s, it became increasingly alarmed that what was happening was creating a kind of economic rival to the United States, a protectionist institution and so on. And both those attitudes have, I think, ebbed and flowed through the subsequent history. You know, positive about the thing in principle, problematic about, anxious about aspects of it in particular. For the United States, I think that relations with the European Union are on a reasonably predictable track. Relations with NATO are a reasonably predictable track, the usual questions about burden sharing and so on. The real problem area is the interface with the Soviet Union, or with Russia, I'm sorry. So that, for example, the position of the Ukraine, the question of Ukraine's membership of NATO, that sort of thing is enormously sensitive to the Russian government, you know, for understandable reasons. I've given a gloomy sense of the Putin government at the end here, but, you know, historically, that's a country that suffered enormously in the past from threats. You know, we simply do not begin to understand what the Second World War meant to that generation who survived it in the Soviet Union. It was on a different order of magnitude from our experience in the West. And although, you know, Russia has now moved on from that period, it was that the stories of the war were kept alive. They are alive still in those cemeteries in Leningrad and elsewhere. And so I think if you scratch the surface, those fears of the creeping West moving eastward are still there. So that's I think, the area that really, really matters.
Michael O'Sullivan, could I press that point a bit? Because I liked your lecture very much, but if I wanted it to be difficult, I'd say it was a bit West European-centric in its view. And if you look at it from a Russian perspective, from Moscow, Russia wasn't defeated in the Cold War. It gave up the Soviet Union. What happened then was that NATO, rather than dissolving itself in the absence of the threat that it had been created to contain, expanded towards Russia. American and British military deployments continued in West Germany after German reunification and continue to this day. So it's possible to look at it from the other perspective, from the East, as a sort of irrational, aggressive stance and a persistence in fighting battles that there was no longer any cause for. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes, well, I can certainly remember in, I think, probably end of November 1989, giving a talk down in London at some conference or other about, I think it was about sort of the future of NATO, and I suggested that, you know, this was actually one of the institutions of Europe that would probably survive. And was several people in the audience just said to me, it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, NATO has lost its rationale now. The Cold War is over. Why? And, of course, in one sense, I have been right. I mean, it has survived. But I agree with you, there is an issue about its rationale. But, in a way, the position of the Soviet Union in 1989-1991, Russia, was analogous to the position of Germany in 1918, you know, that from the Russian perspective, they were calling a halt to the Cold War, so let's dismantle all the institutions. But in the same way as Germany wanted an armistice in 1918 to discuss an equal peace treaty. But then, just as Germany collapsed into complete ruin, so the Soviet Union falls apart. And so what actually comes about is a victor's peace. It is actually on the terms of the West. So I think that you would have to say that, you know, the Russians would have been able to hold up their own end if they had kept the Soviet Union together, if it was an equal ending to the Cold War. Now, should NATO have continued? Well, part of the argument for it was that it provided one of the few ways of holding America and the United States in Europe at a time when there was a possible, you know, reason for America to retreat back into itself. There was also an argument that this was a way of ensuring that European countries were encouraged to make out-of-area commitments, to move beyond, to use the NATO alliance now to look at peacekeeping operations in other parts of the world. So that, yes, I understand, it seems to me perfectly understandable that Russians would have this view of NATO and the EEC, and indeed I tried to suggest that with the map, in a sense, creeping inexorably eastward. I think it's also understandable and, on the whole, probably desirable that some institutions that hold these countries, these European countries together, have survived. And I think European Union and NATO are both hugely problematic organisations, I mean, certainly in the size that they are now. But they are also, it seems to me, they still serve a beneficial function. So I think what we're talking about, again, in answer to the other question, is a long-term process of engagement with Russia that will possibly begin to defuse some of those anxieties.
Carrie Pemberton, there is a debate going on, of course, in the EU at the moment as to how much they should expand right up to the back door of Russia and whether they leave those buffering states in a buffering state situation. But I'm just wondering whether the conversation on the changing map of Europe shifts at all when we bring China into the debate and what's happening in terms of China being a renewed superpower and what that does to the sense of Russians and Russia's place in the world map.
Yeah, well, again, if we're pursuing analogies with Germany and Russia, the German problem all through the 20th century or the first half of the 20th century was the sense of being faced on two sides by threats and insecurities. And Russia, though we don't, don't necessarily appreciate it given our particular map, I'll just run this back. That's not the normal projection we have of Russia. You know, normally we have Russia is on the far eastern edge of a map that's centred on Western Europe. But if you see it there, you can see the size of the country and also this sense of the West and the East and having to face two ways. So, yes, I mean, that has been in the history of Russia, well, over a long period of time, but also in recent times, fundamentally important. I mean, part of the, in 1969, they almost went to war, Russia and China, over their borders and so on. So it's not surprising that this is a country that feels itself encircled as well as needing to pull itself up by the bootstraps from, you know, the Yeltsin era. I mean, Yeltsin, as you know, is just, for most Russians now, is a complete no-no. I mean, he's just a disaster as far as they're concerned. They can't speak a good word of him. Not many good words about Gorbachev, whereas Putin has actually given the country pride again and some sense of security. And so, in a way, they've got to move through that phase and the insecurities of that phase into a new relationship with a world that is changing, you know, on both sides of them.
I'm Mike Breidenbach, I'm a full student in political thought. I recently read Robert Kaplan's article on the revenge of geography in Foreign Policy magazine. It seems that your presentation was premised on the paradigm of historical events influencing geography. I want to press you on to what extent geography influences historical events, that is to say, resources and the kind of land that one has, water borders, etc., and other resources, you know, influencing geography.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, then that would be another lecture, wouldn't it? I mean, that's, you know, one of the great classics of history is Rodel's book about the Mediterranean world, which is premised on those precisely those things of looking at a region, its resources, its climate, and so on, and then, in a sense, drawing its history out of those fundamentals. I have tried to give some sense of geography here, but I've, in a sense, worked more from the top down in terms of the politics and the maps and so on. The history of the United States is about a country that is, you know, proved to be remarkably blessed with natural resources, resources that could be exploited. Many similar large land masses do not have that richness of mineral resources, coal, iron, oil, whatever it is. You take a country of, you know, huge size like Australia. I mean, it's, you know, much of that simply cannot be used effectively for human habitation and exploitation. The Americans have managed to do it partly by massive irrigation and so on. So, yeah, I mean, those are, I think, verities around which you could construct a story. But I also do not want to get into a sort of extreme kind of geodeterminism. And that's why, for example, I did highlight, maybe more than I should, but I don't really feel very penitent, the role of Gorbachev, because I think actually Gorbachev's sense of a different way of running politics, a different way of handling international relations, is of fundamental importance. And if you take that cumulative, rather grim sense that I tried to give of a Europe changing its borders and its character through huge loss of blood, loss of life, then what is so striking about the end of the Cold War in 1989 is how little human life was lost, relatively speaking. And for that, I mean, there are larger explanations, but a significant amount of that is in the hands of that leadership. And not to labour this point, but of course in the summer of 1989, there is also a similar reform movement going on in China. And the attitude of that leadership to reform and political change was fundamentally different. And we will be, I'm sure, reminded of that in the next week or so with the anniversary of Tiananmen Square.
Dudley Ankerson from Sydney Sussex College. I just wondered whether you think that the imbalance in energy resources between Russia on the one hand and Europe on the other offers an opportunity for a rapprochement or better relationship under Putin, or a problem, or both?
I mean, it's been in a sense an issue at various times in the 20th century, and certainly in the détente era, the exploitation of Russian natural resources and its access to the West was an important bridge-building mechanism. Yeah, I think it's a factor. It depends on larger issues of regime relationships and political change as to how that's used. But I think that if one wishes to take an optimistic view, the attitude of the Obama administration towards Russia has been different from the Bush administration, and I think that has registered in Moscow in terms of changing relationships, and natural resources, energy will be part of what's on the table.
Jim Muller, University of Alaska, Anchorage. I wonder if you could just say a little something in closing about the position of Germany in the 21st century. After the deglutition and digestion of East Germany, what the relationship between Germany and the rest of Europe might be, and perhaps bringing it back to where we are, to the UK as well.
Well, let's put it this way, that Helmut Kohl is another political leader who took a considerable gamble. In 1989, taking the view that you should move rapidly to the reunification of Germany, you should do it despite the immediate economic costs, and you should push it through. There was political opportunism, it helped to make him win him an election, all the rest of it, but it was a very clear and deliberate decision. And politically and socially, it made huge sense. Economically, it's still taken Germany a long time to recover from that. And, you know, as you know, if you go to many parts of the old DDR, they are still struggling with large unemployment, problems of making the transition from an old heavy metal economy, and so on. So that, I think, is still there. One of the anxieties in 1989 was, amongst other Western leaders, was that you were then, if you allowed German unification, you were going to create another sort of monster in Europe that would dominate Europe again. That was certainly Mrs. Thatcher's view. It was, I think, the instinct of François Mitterrand in France. And it's striking that the person who took a different view, and quite a decisive one, was George Bush in the United States. George Bush is George I, not George II. If we're talking dynastic politics. George H.W. Bush, George I, had fought in the Second World War, but he'd fought in the Pacific. And as he said, quite frankly, on a number of occasions, I don't have those sort of hang-ups about Germany, the ones that Thatcher and Mitterrand had. And it was, in fact, George Bush's public statement that he did not have a problem with the idea of a unified Germany that really helped to move the process on. And he basically then told Gorbachev that was the basis on which you negotiated. They found a structure to do it, 2+4, two Germanys and four occupying powers, the ex-occupying powers. But basically, he provided the momentum. And I think he's been fundamentally right. I mean, I think that, there isn't really an issue about Germany's place in the new Europe. There are continuing questions about, how Germany uses its military power out of area and whether it should have a significant military power and so on. But, there isn't a German question at the end of the beginning of the 21st century, it seems to me. There is still a Russian question. And I suppose if you think of how bloody the first half of the 20th century was because of the German question, we have, in that sense, moved on.